Coming to you from Houston, Texas, NACE International, the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, brings you the Flint Phenomenon Part 1. NACE International is a not-for-profit association that equips society to protect people, assets, and the environment from the adverse effects of corrosion. Here are your hosts, Ben DeBose and Sammy Miles.
To the inaugural NACE International podcast. I'm Ben DeBose, staff writer with Materials Performance Magazine and with Coatings Pro Magazine.
And I'm Sammy Miles, the managing editor-in-chief of Corrosion Journal.
As many of you may know, the mission of NACE is to equip society to protect people, assets, and the environment from the adverse effects of corrosion. And this new podcast series is our latest way of providing even more insight and resources on many prominent issues related to corrosion.
Our first series, The Flint Phenomenon, takes a look at the corrosion-related issues that led to and resulted from the drinking water crisis in Flint, Michigan. To help us learn more, we have Mark Edwards, professor at Virginia Tech, who led the team that studied water quality in Flint, Michigan, and Darren Lytle with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, who focuses on drinking water treatment technologies.
For reference, this conversation between Sammy, myself, and our two panelists was recorded back in the spring of 2019. So without any further delay, let's play it back.
Currently, we have Mark Edwards with Virginia Tech and Darren Lytle with the Environmental Protection Agency with us on the line. Do you two want to start by telling us a little bit about what happened in Flint, Michigan?
Sure. I can start by saying that I've been predicting something like Flint would occur for about 15 years. This is actually a logical extension of what happened in Washington, D.C. in 2001 and 2004, where kind of weak regulations and utilities cheating in their monitoring and weak regulatory oversight allowed very high lead to occur in Washington, D.C. water for about 3 years. And unfortunately, the agencies involved covered up the health harm at that time. And it actually took about 7 years before people realized that thousands of children had their blood lead elevated from that. And frankly, unfortunately, the lesson learned from that fiasco was that, we can get away with this sort of thing. And it became pervasive throughout the water industry. And eventually, myself and other people like my friend Miguel Del Toro at EPA actually quit the water industry because of this sort of behavior. And so when Flint happened, we weren't really surprised. We got a call from a mom who had a child with elevated blood lead, and we worked with Flint residents to do a citywide sampling event to show that lead in water was high across the city. And there were a lot of amazing EPA employees who'd also been working with her to try to raise alarms. And unfortunately, those alarms were overlooked. And so when it rolled out, it was a kind of a betrayal of public trust. We had a law that wasn't being enforced. Unfortunately, innocent Flint residents were being exposed to high lead for probably a period of 18 months without being told about that or told how to take measures to protect themselves. And so when that story came out, it was a kind of national and international sensation. You've got billions of dollars of lawsuits, class actions. You've got 15 civil servants criminally indicted. You had a federal emergency declared by President Obama and FEMA come in along with agencies trying to help. And Darren Lytle was one of the leaders of the great EPA response to help try to get Flint residents protected and help the system recover.
I want to turn things to Darren. As you mentioned, Darren works with the EPA. He was a leader on this. What was the point, Darren, in which you became involved, that this became clear that this was a subject that clearly needed some leadership and intervention from the EPA's role as well?
I think as Mark indicated, Miguel de Toro was actually in Region 5 was first involved, with communications with resident in the city. And now I got involved later on. I think it was maybe October 2015 or so. I was involved and participated on a technical advisory committee in Flint. And at that point was provided, a lot more information. I mean, I was getting bits and pieces, but at that point wasn't officially brought on or involved until that request to participate. And at that point, that was at a point where they were making the decision to change back to their original source, the Detroit water source. So at that point, they had gone through a period of time where they were using this alternative water, the Flint River water that they were trying to treat themselves. And at that point, it made the decision to go back. So I think that's when we really got involved and boots on the ground kind of thing and assisted in many ways from there on out.
What were the initial missteps, and this can be for either of you two, that were made in the immediate aftermath of identifying the problem? Because as you said, there was a period of about several months in which there wasn't a clear strategic direction. They tried some different things. Yeah. What were the initial steps that they took that were unsatisfactory, just to recap where things went wrong, especially after they already identified they had a problem?
Well, I mean, let's back up. I mean, let's remind ourselves of the problem for those that don't recall. I mean, so the city made a decision, and there were multiple people involved, I guess, with that decision, whether, was a resource issue, is certainly a part of it. But they made a decision to go off of their longtime water source, the source water from Detroit's water system. And in making that change, they went to a source water in the Flint River that was different. And water quality wise, it's a source that is variable in terms of its water chemistry and water quality. And they also brought online and made the attempt to use their old treatment facility, which wasn't used regularly. It was a backup treatment facility in case something happened to Detroit's water source, they could use it. So they didn't have a lot of experience with it. So the fact that they're now using this variable, flashy in a sense, water source, this new water source, and also a new treatment plant, well, old treatment plant, but trying to operate it and just didn't have the experience. The resulting water quality or water chemistry coming out of that system was quite a bit variable and quite a bit different. And on top of it, they discontinued the orthophosphate feed, which was an integral part of their corrosion control program and minimizing or reducing lead levels in the distribution system. That was discontinued as well. So between those things, it was a big change. And I always say distribution systems, hate change. And that was a huge change. And as a result, the distribution system reacted in, of course, a very bad way. It just wasn't lead. Lead was, of course, a big part of it. And, but they had red water problems. Initially, the problems that they encountered were disinfection byproduct issues because the new source, the Flint River, had a higher organic carbon content. And because also, too, they've got these corrosion problems that have been generated as a result of this change. They were adding a lot more chlorine to try to maintain a chlorine residual, so they had disinfection byproduct issues. So there's a lot of issues going on, and I think initially, and I think one of the things we've learned is that you have to react quickly. When you start to see problems, when you start to see red water and you start to not be able to maintain a chlorine residual, and you got a lot of fluctuations. I mean, you got to react quickly, and I think certainly there wasn't the quick reaction that needed to take place to kind of address the issues up front when they first recognized them.
And put simply, federal corrosion control was not followed when they brought this new water online. And when it became realized in early 2015 that was a problem, rather than fix it, the state covered that up. And that's really the source of the crime. It's never really the initial mistake that gets you, but rather if you start working to cover it up, that's always what looks bad. And that's why there are 15 people who were criminally indicted, mostly scientists and engineers at the state. And that's why there's such outrage over what occurred. And so all of these problems started with a failure to implement corrosion control law. Go figure. That's why we have the law. Not only did that cause discolored water, distasteful water, but it led to lead exposure of children, and also is very likely to have triggered a Legionnaires' disease outbreak that had anywhere from 12 to 14 deaths. So all of that came from the failure to implement the law, and as Darren said, to respond quickly once it became realized that there was a problem.
I know you at Virginia Tech, you all, in the aftermath of that, I believe it was August 2015 that you published your study. Is that right?
We were working with Miguel Del Toro at EPA and, you know, and the Flint mom, and we took samples from her house in early 2015.
Yes.
That showed she was getting hazardous waste levels of lead out of her tap. And so we wanted to stay in the background and let EPA do their job. And Miguel did an extraordinary effort. He wrote a memo up outlining the dangers to Flint residents. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, that memo was essentially covered up, and Miguel was not allowed to continue his work. So EPA has culpability for this, at least from that point on, in my opinion, because the head of Region 5, she ultimately had to resign because of how this was handled. So our work was really just trying to assist EPA, ethical actors in EPA, to expose this. And unfortunately, they weren't successful. And when Miguel was no longer allowed to continue that work, we started a very public campaign to sample the water and to call out folks who weren't being completely honest with the public. And that included, unfortunately, the EPA and the state of Michigan. It was a very high profile, stressful battle where, you know, there were attempts made to discredit us. And, you know, in the end, we persevered and the truth persevered, and folks realized that this was a serious problem. And it didn't take long after our results that showed there was high lead throughout the city in an unprecedented sampling campaign where essentially we were doing the job that the state is supposed to do. The citizens led a campaign. And there was also a study with a medical doctor there I collaborated with, Mona Hanatisha, where she looked at her blood lead data just like I did back in the DC crisis and showed in real time that children's blood lead was rising. And so within a few days after those studies came out, the state started, they basically threw the towel in. They started cooperating. They immediately switched back to the new source. And frankly, from my opinion, from that point onward, you know, EPA and the state were allies in trying to get the problem fixed. So it really just took, I guess, a formation of a critical mass to show that there was a problem. And then generally speaking, the agencies were doing their job. And after January of 2016, when Obama declared the federal emergency, I have nothing but strong praise for how all the agencies handled that. And that included, you know, the efforts of Miguel, who was suddenly now allowed to work on this again, and Darren, Mike Schock, hundreds of EPA employees, hundreds of federal state employees were there trying to do the job as best they could to help Flint recover and implement the improved corrosion control and infrastructure upgrades that have led us to dramatically improved water quality in Flint in the 3 years since that time.
Has anything changed from the way that towns and city governments, states, how they approach things like this when they're looking at changing, let's say, their water source or anything relating to their infrastructure? Are they thinking ahead? Are they trying to incorporate preventative actions? Have we seen anybody take more initiative after Flint?
I mean, I can speak for myself and my experiences, and I'll say, yeah. I mean, there's certainly a growing larger awareness now following, you know, Flint, and you know, and I mean, we know because we get, you know, we get the phone calls. I mean, I think after things sort of settled down, well, even towards the end of some of the busiest times and most active times in Flint, things, the phone's ringing off the hook. You know, we get phone calls from states, from our regional offices, from cities and communities who I think are starting to recognize that, you know, the word's getting out that is, look, you know, you have to be careful when you make changes. And even little changes, you know, and people are starting to say, hey, you know, I want to make this change. You know, how do I go about this in a way that's going to, you know, minimize upsetting my distribution system? And so I think you know, that's great and it's interesting, been interesting because a lot of the times we've, you know, in some of these situations, we're not even sure, you know, we're not sure how the system's going to respond because there's some areas we'll say that are kind of new in a sense of new territories, new areas that we haven't even really thought about, like how some subtle changes will impact the distribution system. So people are aware, they're asking a lot of questions and they're not jumping into it. At least, I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but we're getting the phone calls and people are asking the right questions.
And I think the other thing is, a message was sent that do not be the next Flint.
Mm-hmm.
So across the country, residents complain and regulatory agencies are asked questions after the indictments, after all the bad publicity, much of which was deserved, hopefully ethical actors in these agencies could now get listened to because previously they were dismissed. So I've seen a strong desire to not become the next Flint in many municipalities and regulatory agencies around the country. That's good news. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the lessons that we could have learned from Flint weren't necessarily learned. So in other words, the importance of corrosion control, investing in better understanding, looking at water infrastructure nationally. We talk a lot about our F-grade pipes that are out of sight, out of mind, leaking, causing health problems, whether it's lead or Legionella. And all of that talk has not led to action. And so we know that we really have to replace a lot of these old pipes, this antiquated infrastructure, whether it's lead or unlined iron that caused the Flint water disaster. But, you know, since that's not going to happen anytime soon, it has to happen someday. You'd like it to happen proactively, not reactively, but that's not how we work. So the net result is corrosion control is more important than ever. You know, we have to get more out of these assets. And studies have shown that for every dollar invested in corrosion control in drinking water systems, there's $5 to $10 of benefit in terms of increased lifetime of the plumbing system, whether it's the city system or the building plumbing. But we now have to factor in the health implications too, which were neglected previously, like how much it costs for lead exposure, how much does it cost for lawsuits, what is a life loss from Legionella worth? And so the cost equation has probably changed in people's mind. It's not just the dollar in corrosion control saving $5 to $10 of reduced damage. It's public trust. It's life and death.
What are some of the technical solutions? We talk a lot about the corrosion inhibitors, which make a lot of sense, especially when there's already an issue. Is there a role for protective coatings on some of these lines? Just curious from your experience, when you give these outlooks to cities, municipalities moving forward, what some of the technical options are that are going to help them with this corrosion problem?
Darren, do you want to?
Well, certainly, things that can help us, and certainly things that we've learned in Flint are the importance of things like sampling. You know, we have our lead and copper rule of monitoring, but there are other approaches that we could apply to help us in our decisions and inform us as to what's going on. For example, sequential profiling sampling, you know, where you take a series of samples one after the other, and that gives you a sense as to what's so looking at sampling. The importance of lead service line in scale analysis of pipes and other components in the home plumbing system, you know, and understanding what minerals are there and what other things are there. I think we're focused on, you know, our lead solubility models and using those as a predictive tool as to how lead's going to react to water chemistry changes. But when you start to look at the pipe scales, you realize that there's a lot of other stuff going on. You know, there's aluminum and there's manganese and iron and other things incorporated into these scales. And it just makes us, you know, we have to be aware that it's just not corrosion control, but it's the whole picture. I mean, that goes back, it takes us back to the treatment facility, right? And managing our water treatment facility, because if those things are there, which could potentially come from the treatment plant, you know, we have to manage our water treatment plant as well and think about the whole picture. The water use and the role of particles and the importance of, you know, we're talking about removing lead service line, you know, but we have to identify where they're at. And I think there's some issues there. So I don't know, just a couple of thoughts there.
What resources are available to help educate citizens. So we're talking about the technologies that are out there, but what would you encourage the citizens and officials to do about corrosion, their drinking water? Should they be alerting people when they see things off?
Yeah. We've been funded by the EPA to kind of look at that, and includes everything from how do consumers test? Do they use local labs or those test kits that they can get off the shelf? How do people respond to consumer complaints? How do they diagnose problems and determine whether it's just a discoloration issue or whether it's a health issue? So there's quite a bit of research in progress on that issue at the present moment. And we've got a long way to go because this is a very, very complicated problem. You can't make up a problem more difficult to deal with this lead problem. Everything from whose responsibility is it? It's unlike any other drinking water contaminant because it's a shared responsibility. The lead sources oftentimes are in your building plumbing system, unlike every other contaminant that the water utilities deal with, which are all the rest are completely under their control one way or another. And so you have the legal issues, you have the ethical dimension, because some of the lead sources are government owned, the lead service lines that connect houses to buildings, to the water main. And so you have a government-owned lead source that directly affects a product intended for human consumption. And it's there many times because it was the law that homeowners use a lead pipe to connect. And then you've got just incredible complexity wherein, you know, we're really talking about pieces of lead detaching and falling off into the water. And so you can't just sample one time and be done with it. Many times where there's problems with elevated blood lead in children's homes, you can sample the water and find it's low sometimes, and then every now and then a chunk of lead falls off, and that's enough that if that got caught up in your food or you drank it, that could elevate your blood lead in a single glass. So, you know, this is you can't imagine a more stickier ethical, scientific, or moral problem to deal with. And how we're going to sort this all out over the next few years remains to be seen. But all of the above is going to become important. That includes lead pipe replacement, doing that right, perhaps using coatings, better corrosion control, better educating consumers, better educating cities about how to make sure that they're doing everything they can.
Yeah, and I'll just add too, I mean, you know, to reinforce the education piece, I mean, that's a challenge. You know, I mean, the Flint situation in itself just sort of illustrates that, you know, we need to continue to educate people in making decisions and how to go about it. I mean, the issue, as Mark said, is complicated, and there are many factors that go into it. And how we get the message out, you know, in creative ways to get to everybody, to get to the right people. You know, we have to educate the engineers who are making decisions, who are working for the community, so they're making the right decisions and they have the latest data and latest information we have to deal with and help. You know, homeowners and communities. And so it's a challenge. I mean, we do trainings, we do webinars, we have other tools available to us, but it's a huge challenge to get to everybody. There's messaging issues. And I know when we were in Flint, I mean, that was a big issue. We're trying to communicate things to the residents in a way that they understand it, and then also help other folks, maybe engineers and other folks, trying to understand some of the technical aspects of things.
You mentioned earlier, parts of lead falling off into the water, and so you have to sample multiple times. But do we know where all the lead is in this country? Do we know whether within a city, which pipes are still lead-based and which aren't?
Well, that's the biggest challenge. So in Flint and as in D.C., ultimately to figure out if you had a lead pipe in front of your house, you had to dig a hole in almost every yard because the records were lost or they were so inaccurate. And that's what makes this a nightmare of problem, because if we just knew where all the lead pipes were, the lead service line pipes, we could target our public health messaging to those individuals. But because you do not know, what do you do with that mess? What do you do when someone asks you in your city, do I have a lead pipe that's owned by the government? And you have to tell them, I don't know. I don't know where these pipes are. And so you then have to say, do we have to give the messaging that folks who have a lead pipe deserve to protect themselves, which might unfortunately be that you really can't trust the water coming from a lead pipe, that you and your family, if you have one of these lead pipes in front of your house, might want to use bottled water or lead filters, which are very effective, by the way, and are not that costly. You know, for $30 off the shelf at Lowe's, you can put one of these on the end of your faucet and treat the water used for cooking or drinking and be done with it. It doesn't matter what levels of lead are in your water supply, because these filters work. And, you know, so you're then looking at the cost of one sample to get an imperfect answer. Is my lead in water high or not? Gee, I don't know, because what does one sample tell you? For that price, you could buy a solution that's virtually 100% effective in terms of getting rid of the lead problem. So the lack of knowledge about where these lead pipes are is really just the biggest problem. And it's a nightmare. It's a public relations nightmare. And perception is reality, too. Like, for, let's say, the 98%, 99% of Americans who maybe don't have a lead pipe in front of their house, do they have to act like they do in order to protect themselves? And so many of our poorest Americans are afraid in the aftermath of Flint that they're just assuming their water's unsafe and they're buying filters and bottled water. And that's a real tragedy. So, you know, perception for them has become reality because of the loss of trust. Our most vulnerable are those with the least ability to pay. Many times are spending their precious financial resources on filters and bottled water when they don't have to.
I'll just reiterate. I mean, Mark's right. I mean, we certainly recognize that identifying where those service lines are is a priority. And I know there's a lot of work going on and efforts going on to kind of look at things from a kind of a macro scale mapping of where the service lines are, but they're based on records that, you know, sometimes aren't real accurate. And getting down, though, and drilling down to, you know, the house and the individual household and assessing whether a lead service line is present or not is a research priority for us at the EPA. And we're looking at ways to kind of, you know, through alternatives to, you know, digging up the entire yard and getting away from the cost associated with that, but looking at things like in different ways we could sample the water, perhaps, or and looking at some kind of creative sampling device type approaches that could be used to help identify those service lines. So definitely it's an issue that we need to pay some attention to.
Mark, I want to circle back to a comment you made a few minutes ago. We spent a lot of this discussion looking at replacement options. We've discussed inhibitors. We've talked about measurement techniques. You mentioned that there is a role potentially for protective coatings in some of these situations. Where is it that coatings are potentially applicable? And where is it that you may be looking at, you know, obviously inhibitors, we've mentioned the lead replacement. Just curious what the role is for coatings in your mind and what the situations are that might lend itself to that.
Well, the inhibitors are a necessary band-aid until such time as we get the lead pipe materials out of contact with the water. And we have to do better with that, because that's, you know, not just saving us money in terms of damaged infrastructure, but it's protecting public health, even for those who don't take steps like buying bottled water or filters or flushing to protect themselves. And that's very important. But, you know, coatings play a key role in both the water mains, which are unlined iron in many cases. And if we can't replace them, to the extent that you can line them and prevent those rusty pipes from contacting the water, that reduces problems with bacteria and to some extent even affects the lead issue and discolored water. So, you know, that's one of the approaches to try to mitigate that problem. In terms of coatings, you know, these lead service lines that connect your house to the water mains, once you find them, you can either dig them up, replace them, or you can try to, you know, put liners into them, whether they're epoxy. And that can be very effective to the extent that you completely line that lead pipe. It's no longer a lead pipe contacting the water. But there's a lot of concern that will these coatings stick around for a long time, or if they break, then are we just going to have the lead pipe again? So even though it looks like they have a very good record and they're a little bit less expensive than actually replacing the entire lead pipe, there's a lot of resistance that maybe this is a poor person solution, and that we're potentially leaving this problem. That if the coating dissipates in any way, shape, or form, we're back to where we started from. And I think that those perceptions are going to be hard to overcome. But it is done in England, by the way. They're actually epoxy coating pipes in it. It's very effective. It's an accepted solution there. But I've just seen very big resistance in communities in the United States of anything less than complete replacement of the lead pipe once and for all.
Why do you think that is? Is it because of these catastrophic failures like what we've seen in Flint? Coatings seem to be a good mitigation step, but I suppose the difference, as you said, is with England, perhaps they have not had the public failures. And so since there's a public failures here, there's more of a desire, or at least there could be, to go an all-out replacement method. Is that the thought process? Or I'm just curious why you think there's such a discrepancy between the U.S. and England on this.
Well, I can say that, many of the communities who are affected by the lead pipe problem, I mean, we look at what happened in Flint, for example, and it's the poorest city in America. And the problem was triggered by the fact that they were trying to save some money. And so there's a very strong pushback, and deservedly so, about the idea of saving 20% on a solution that might not be 100% effective. Now, the heavy emphasis is it might not be. And so, the whole idea from a perspective of a community that the correct way to fix this problem, the government problem, which is the lead service line, is to get that lead pipe out of the ground, out of contact with the water forever. And so the idea of putting like a thin plastic barrier of some sort on there, it sounds like they're trying to save 20% and not give them the fully 100% guaranteed solution. Mm-hmm. Now, the solution might be 99.99% effective, but obviously with this perception of the Flint water crisis, trying to essentially save pennies on the dollar and having it blow up in your face, such approaches just aren't politically attractive, nor are they accepted by many of these communities.
That will do it for part one of our Flint Phenomenon series, but please stay tuned in the weeks ahead for part two of our discussion with Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech and Darren Lytle of the EPA. Until then, if you want more information, you can visit NACE International online at nace.org, or you can go to any of our three NACE publication websites. That's Corrosion Journal at corrosionjournal.org, Materials Performance at materialsperformance.com, or Coatings Pro Magazine at coatingspromag.com. We'd also appreciate it if you subscribe to the podcast at wherever you're listening right now and leave 5-star reviews if you enjoy it, because we're definitely planning more episodes in the weeks and months ahead. Again, I'm Ben Dubose, and special thanks to Sammy Miles for her work moderating this episode. For now, we hope you all enjoy the rest of your day, and thanks so much for listening to the first ever NACE International podcast. Please check back soon for more.